Digital has given every voice a platform. Will yours be heard? If there is one skill that everyone needs today, it's not just the ability to communicate, it's the ability to connect. My mission is to give you the communication skills you'll need to inform and inspire, sometimes using digital tools, but always with human outcomes. In this episode, we are taking flight with Jen Barkenhagen.
She said to me, we as women will always have to work twice as hard to be taken half as seriously as our male counterparts. To her, it was a battle cry. And to many women, that is a battle cry. And I appreciate, respect, and admire those women. I am not of that opinion, but I see that as a warning sign. If you're in an organization that makes you work twice as hard because of the very fact that you're a woman, to be taken half as seriously, then that's not an organization that I want to be a part of, or it's an organization that needs to change. It's not women that need to change.
Let's begin. Jen Barkenhagen is just finishing her first rotation in the Strategy and Integration Leadership Development Program at Wyndham Destinations. She has her MBA from the University of Florida and spent 6 years as an active duty intelligence officer for the United States Air Force. She is also still serving in the Air Force Reserves, supporting the 920th Rescue Wing, and it has brought her to our show. Jen, thank you so much for coming.
It's an honor to be here. I'm so excited.
So Jen, let's talk about your current role. You're in a leadership development program as a manager for Wyndham Destinations. Tell us about your role.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a 2-year rotational program. It's the Strategy and Integration Leadership Development Program for Wyndham Destinations. My first rotation was in on a team called Business Improvement and Quality. So we call it BizIQ for short, kind of a cool name. And we pretty much act as internal consultants for our resort operations staff and partners and team members. So anything that we can do to make their lives more streamlined, more simple, easier, and also make the guest experience great, those are the kind of projects that we take on. And then as I rotate here in about a week, I'll go to the business operations team, and they directly support our sales and marketing sites. So projects that deal with contract standards or any issues that may arise during the contracting process with the site level, but also some really exciting new technology, like we're rolling out Salesforce as our marketing management tool. So some very exciting things happening at Wyndham Destinations, and the technology kind of keeps rolling and keeps pushing us forward, which I think is really cool.
It's interesting, the tourism industry has seen a lot of disruption. And so I'm sure that it is very exciting to be able to look at new technologies and innovation and get people to think differently about tourism.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's interesting, we get the question a lot. You know, I've been doing recruiting this fall as well for new members for our LDP. And a lot of the questions we get are things about Airbnb or other companies that have really disrupted the hospitality industry. And our answer is usually that Wyndham Destinations is the number one timeshare company in the world, or vacation ownership company in the world. And we're number one by a long shot. I think the number two competitor is less than half of the revenue in the business that we do. So we've been number one for a long time for a reason. But our new CEO, Mike Brown, we just spun off of the Wyndham Hotel Group, or we spun them off because we're a larger company, and became Wyndham Destination. So our new CEO, Mike Brown, is all about not resting on our laurels and really pushing the envelope. And he said, technology is a place that we have an opportunity to grow. It hasn't been a focus area for a lot of years for this company. And so that leaves us with a lot of opportunities, which makes it very exciting and an exciting time to be with the company.
Well, it sounds like the kind of leader you like. I say that because you and I have known each other for a while and you've had a number of leadership roles. Let me ask you, do you consider yourself a natural leader?
Yeah, you know, I do consider myself a natural leader. And that's honestly even a little bit difficult to like say or to come to terms with, say, yes, I'm a natural leader. That's something that comes naturally to me. I think that A lot of women, specifically female leaders, have what's called imposter syndrome. And so we worry that, someday somebody will discover that the things I've been saying about myself aren't true, even though that's, that isn't true. We do have the skills and ability to lead. I've been a leader as long as I can really remember. It's funny, when you're young, the way you become the leader of the group is you're the one with the opinions, or you're the one willing to share your opinions. And I think anybody that's met me will attest that I'm never afraid to share my opinions, and kind of be the one on the forefront saying what either I believe or what the team around me believes. So that made it easy from a young age to really be seen as a leader and to become a leader and develop those skills. Now, I would like to think that my leadership style has refined a bit from just being the loudest or the one willing to step up, since those early days. But I think it's still important as a leader to be willing to speak for your team and to be able to not only be the mouthpiece, but also to be the one removing barriers so that your team can succeed and can get their opinions out as well.
I can picture you on the school playground as one of the team captains, picking members of your team. Were you that person?
I think I have a big personality. That's something I've always been known for, kind of wherever I go, is, being this sort of larger than life personality, and that attracts people to you naturally. And then I think one of the things I've learned as I've grown is that that comes with responsibility. And so how do I sort of be a good steward of people's trust? As early on as, being a team captain on the playground and making sure that everybody gets to play, or everybody, gets the opportunity to shine, or if you're really good at one thing, that's going to be your job and you're going to do that thing so well. And you're going to really bring our team to success, and kind of how that's evolved for me as a leader in, the teams I lead and have led in the past.
That's pretty amazing that you were already thinking about leadership and development, as opposed to what most kids do, who act as an authoritarian and just everyone's supposed to listen to me.
Yeah, and it's probably funny and maybe a little bit weird to hear a military officer say, I don't rely on authority. I think authority is sometimes a crutch that leaders use, and if you have to rely on authority, then you've kind of lost a little bit of your leadership quality. And from the beginning, I've always tried to be somebody who sees the best in others. The people around me will always say, I have a big heart. I always see the best in others, which can also be, something I have to be careful of. I trust easily. But from a leadership standpoint, it's like, I don't know if you've done Strength Finders or you've heard of Strength Finders, but one of my top five strengths is individualization, which basically means I like to take the thing that somebody is good at or very interested in and bring that out in them as a strength, and to let them show that and develop that and shine through that, what makes them unique. And that's kind of the way I've always led my teams, and I plan to continue to lead in that way.
That's fantastic. Most leaders have or had mentors as they were coming through the ranks. And I often wonder if that's the case with all women leaders. The reason why I say that is because of the representation of women in leadership roles. For instance, a 2017 study conducted by Lean In.org and McKinsey and Company states that women continue to be unrepresented at the leadership level. I don't think that's a surprise. It went on to say that white women make up only 18% of the C-suite, and women of color make up only 3%. Have you ever felt alone when taking on your leadership roles?
I think that's a great question. I think that it's something that I hadn't really thought about until now, until you kind of just asked that question, is have I felt alone? And I think I've been lucky. The military is obviously a male dominated, or perceived as a male dominated organization. And for the most part, that's true. I was lucky to be an intelligence officer, and in the intelligence community, women are actually a majority, in that community. So even though women in a leadership role may be underrepresented, I think the military, and especially intel, really help build the basis on credibility and say, we're gonna promote you, or we're going to give you additional roles and leadership opportunities based on your merit, based on your credibility, and based on how well you do your job. Now, that's not to say there haven't been hurdles, and there aren't, you know, the couple of leaders or people that I've run into who do believe in maybe a more archaic viewpoint of how leadership should be. But I wouldn't say that I've felt alone necessarily. In the military, because they put a lot of emphasis on standardizing everything from the, you know, what you wear to work to, you know, how women do their hair, how men wear their hair, it's a lot of, they take a lot of those extraneous variables out of the equation. And so what becomes, you know, at the forefront is your ability. And so it's always been important to me to make sure I fulfill that responsibility and be a good steward of, you know, my demographic, my gender. But I do see in the corporate world that at the highest levels, it's mostly men. And I always think to myself, why is that? When, you know, maybe the director or the VP level below that are maybe more women. And I think, at least for me, it's a little bit of that imposter syndrome creeping back in. Women are historically, you know, studies have shown that women are less likely to apply for jobs that they feel they're not already capable of doing, where their male counterpart with the same skills will apply for that job and say, you know what, when I get this job, I'll figure out how to do it. Women won't apply for that job until they say, I could do this job well on day one. And so I think that may be the difference and the kind of the dichotomy between the way, why we have more male leaders than female leaders. Male leaders are just more willing to step up and say, you know what, I'll figure it out as I go. And women want to make sure that we can do the job, you know, from day one.
You know, that's interesting. And it gets me thinking about another study that I was looking at. And it showed that when all leadership contexts are considered, men and women do not differ in perceived leadership effectiveness. So when organizations were surveyed, there seemed to be no difference between the genders as to how they view their leaders. But here's something very, very interesting. When self-ratings are only examined in the study, men rate themselves as significantly more effective than women rate themselves. So I wonder, is leadership a state of mind? I mean, we go back to your thought about, you know, a woman may want to wait until she's perfect at this role so she can take it on and be qualified, whereas a man may say, oh, you know, I think I have what it takes to learn and get it, and then they just go for it.
Yeah, I definitely think that leadership is a state of mind, and even more, I think it's a state of being, which it kind of just takes that a step farther, because it's not only how you perceive yourself in your mind, but also what you do with that perception. Or, you know, if you think I'm a leader, I can do this, you also have to turn that into action and turn around and actually, you know, follow through with the things that you believe. And I think that that may be where male leaders and female leaders differ a little bit. Male leaders definitely believe I'm the best at this job, I can do it. And then how they differ from women is women believe, you know what, I'm pretty sure I could do this. I think I might be pretty good at this. Let me see if I'm good at this. And then they start to sort of exercise those leadership skills and abilities in the places that they are already. So if you have a female leader, she probably is more in tune to your emotions, to your emotional state, as well as the business side or the, you know, the operational side of things. That's something that, you know, studies have shown that women are, you know, more in tune with that emotional intelligence is higher. And so I think that while leadership is definitely a state of mind and you have to really believe in yourself, I have this meme that I always refer to. I've actually printed it out. I have it on a magnet. It's a little kitten and this kitten is wearing a shark costume. And it says, sometimes you just have to tell yourself, I am a shark and attack the day. And I really like that as a mindset. You know, even if you're not a shark, you're just wearing a shark costume, you can say, you know what, I'm a shark and I'm going to behave like a shark. And here I go, you know, I'm going to attack this. And so I think that having that state of mind allows me specifically as a leader to then turn that into action. But I think that women often have to be a little more present, a little more intentional about doing that. It doesn't come as naturally to change, to turn that mindset into action. But once they figure out how to do it, they are in tune with it and they know that it has to be done.
You know, let me just ask, where did you find your views and values? How are they formed? Did you have strong female leadership role models coming up? Or were you surrounded by, you know, male role models who served as a great example for you? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think my first leader, my first role model is my dad. He is retired military as well. He was a master chief in the Navy, which is the highest enlisted rank you can attain. He was in the Navy for 22 years, but I am an only child and I'm obviously a woman. So I think that his leadership style to me was maybe different than his leadership style, even at work, but I got a good mix of I'm the princess, but at the same time, my dad means business and he's about getting stuff done and he's going to teach me that as well. So I think I got a good mix of that. Like, you have to take charge and do this. And also, you know, you're still feminine. You're still a princess. That's okay. And it's okay to kind of embrace both sides of that personality. And later on in the military, I've had some great mentors and some, like, what I think of as reverse mentors, or maybe anti-mentors is a better word, where somebody taught me something that I didn't want to do, or I didn't want to, you know, emulate in the future. I have a specific story. There was a female officer who told me, and this was late in my active duty career, so almost maybe 6 to 8 months before I left active duty, she said to me, we as women will always have to work twice as hard to be taken half as seriously as our male counterparts. And that, to me, to her, it was a battle cry. And to many women, that is a battle cry. And I appreciate, respect, and admire those women. I am not of that opinion. And for whatever reason, maybe it's my upbringing, maybe it's just, I don't know what it is, but I see that as a warning sign. If you're in an organization that makes you work twice as hard because of the very fact that you're a woman, to be taken half as seriously, then that's not an organization that I want to be a part of, or it's an organization that needs to change. It's not women that need to change. And I know Lean In, I listened to the audiobook of Lean In, and I think that what she says, what the practical advice she gives women is great, in the sense that it gives us tools to start changing the perception of women. And she tells us, you know, you may have to alter your actions slightly, or think of yourself in a different way in order to become the contributor, you know, to lean into the table, to have a seat at the table. But the whole point of acting that way is to change the culture around you. It's not to change yourself to be different, to be more palatable to the male leaders in your life. And I think that's a key, kind of a key distinction and a key point to my leadership style and my beliefs on, you know, the leader, women in leadership as a whole.
That's a very interesting position you hold, and I bet engenders a lot of conversation. There's another study that I wanted to mention that I wanted to get your feedback on. So one study I read in Science Direct made an interesting observation. It said that when women hold powerful positions, they have a harder time than men eliciting respect and admiration, or status, I guess you could call it, from subordinates. And as a result, female power holders are seen as less legitimate than male power holders. As a young woman in leadership roles, have you seen or experienced similar situations?
Yeah, I have seen that. And I think that it's upsetting when you do see it, when you can feel it or perceive it specifically. It's definitely upsetting. And it's honestly one of the reasons that I chose to continue my career outside of active duty military service, because I felt that that culture was so ingrained, and that even though Intel is a majority, you know, has a majority of women, and they strip away some of those variables, there are still those leaders in power positions that, and even subordinates or peers in powerful positions, that will always see women as not belonging or as less than their male counterparts. But specifically, those instances I feel have always made me stronger, have always made me, you know, continue to question the status quo, but also to push myself a little harder. And when I was younger, I did see that, like, kind of what my, you know, my female counterpart had said. I saw that as a battle cry. And then as I grew up and as I learned a little more, I started to see that it's not me that's the problem. You know, it's not women as leaders that are the problem. It's the culture around us. And so we need to work to continue to change that perception. As far as subordinates go, I have what I consider a fairly distinct leadership style when it comes to subordinates. A lot of military leaders especially are fearful of what they call like the line. You know, don't cross the line. Don't be too personal with your subordinates, because there is a distinct line in our regulation that dictates what sort of social interactions you can and can't have with members of, you know, the enlisted corps as an officer. And so that's written down. But what it doesn't say is that you have to be cold or impersonal, or, and a lot of leaders will try to say, oh, you have to ask your subordinates about their lives, and you have to know about their, you know, their spouse's name and their kids' names and what's going on. And but it's always, to me, when it's said that way, it's always like a check the box. Like, to be a good leader, you must do this. You have to know all the names of your subordinates, kids, and spouses. But for me, my style is to actually be a human to those people. And I've found in multiple occasions on with multiple teams that when your subordinates and your peers see you as a human, see you as a fellow person who maybe likes some of the things that they do, maybe goes out and has a drink on the weekends and is okay with that. You know, when they see you as a person instead of a robot just doing a job, they're much more likely to come to you with their problems, to suggest innovative solutions to things, to work harder because they believe that you're on the same team. And so I found that that's something that I feel women do better than men in the military, and, you know, and otherwise, is that we, because we're more emotionally attuned to the needs of the people around us, we can perceive that and be able to utilize that and encourage that teamwork. I used to, when I had my team at Shaw Air Force Base, I used to have a meeting in the mornings after a weekend, and we would just sit around for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes in the morning, and we'd have donuts or coffee or whatever, and we'd talk about our weekends, and we'd talk about what we did, and, you know, it wasn't work related. And so very quickly, I learned that I actually had things in common with the people that I, you know, w oversaw, and they learned that they had things in common with me. And that genuine connection was something that I think made our team one of the strongest in our shop.
I really appreciate that. And as I listen to that, I take that as a best practice to avoid taking a prescriptive role and take more of a personal role in those whom you lead. So thank you for sharing that. I think this is a good time to shift gears just a little bit and really focus on what's important on this show, and that's communication. And as a leader, I know communication is very important. And so I'd like to, talk to you about your communication styles and your best practices, both in the military and outside civilian life or in the corporate world.
Yeah, I think the best practice, kind of like I was just saying, is really taking that personal approach to leadership. And the communication shouldn't be authoritative. The communication should be, we are a team. We are contributing to a goal. You know, we're all kind of going toward this goal together, rather than, you team, you're going toward this goal so that I can claim it as a win on my performance report this year. And I think that, you know, best practices as far as communication goes are just to do it more often, you know, to communicate in a genuine way as much as you can. If you're not comfortable with this style of communication, that's okay. You can get better at it. In fact, you know, a specific story, I see oral communication or like personal communication differently than I see email communication. And this sort of brings in the digital side of things too. in a world where we kind of rely on email on a day-to-day basis, you have to be very careful about how those emails are perceived. And that's something that I struggled with early on, because I see email as a business transaction, as a business, you know, that's an email that's sent because I need to get something done, I need something done, or I need to move something forward. And so I found that my emails were almost too brusque, too kind of direct and to the point, and it was putting people off, especially because if they met me in person, I'm very warm, personable, big personality, and then they'd get an email from me and they'd think, oh, is she mad at me, or did I do something wrong? And it wasn't because I intended that, but it was just because I saw it as a business transaction rather than an extension of our personal relationship or our, you know, our communications in person. And so that was something that I had to take as a lesson learned and kind of adapt. And especially in the corporate world, I'm finding even more than in the military, this is very important. You know, we go to a 30-minute meeting and the first 10 minutes are talking about, you know, how was your weekend? How's your family? You know, how was your vacation? Whatever is going on in their life. And then we get to the business, and the emails within our company are seen very much the same way. So now, you know, I lead emails with, hey, how are you doing? You know, how was your new year? How was your holiday? Rather than just being like, hey, you know, that thing we were working on, you know, before we all went on vacation, can we go back to working on that? You know, I need to adjust my style to make sure that I'm perceived in the same way. And then I'm establishing and kind of building those relationships through all forms of communication, not just face-to-face communication.
Communication in the digital space is definitely growing. And you and I are in the talent and development business. And certainly one area that's somewhat new for talent and development is social. What have you seen as far as success goes with communicating through social for talent and development? And, you know, how do you view it?
Yeah, I think that LinkedIn now being the powerhouse tool, excuse me, that it is, has really kind of merged that hiring interview piece with the social media piece. I have only recently kind of jumped on the bandwagon. I've had a LinkedIn for a long time, but recently I've started using it almost as my go-to social media platform. And now, again, kind of going back to what I was just saying about the difference in communication with email versus personal, LinkedIn is another challenge. You know, it's not Facebook, it's not Instagram, it's not a true social media platform, but it is a tool, a professional tool, to create that personal relationship with the people that you work with or potentially could work with or people that you would like to influence. And I think that the social media revolution is something that we have to be aware of, and we have to sort of start utilizing. If we don't, then that your company falls behind. And nobody wants to be seen as that, you know, that old crotchety company that, you know, still makes you fill out a paper application when, you know, I have a PDF copy of my resume right here. And I even know some companies recently that are doing a culture fit test as part of the interview process. And one of the options is to let the program analyze your social media. So you give them your, you know, your Facebook login, or not login, but your, you know, handle or your LinkedIn, you know, name, and they'll analyze your social media presence and then determine if you would be a culture fit for their company, which is very, I think, cutting edge, but also a little scary. Especially in the world we see, you know, that even new Congress women or people specifically, are having to deal with the reality that we have social media lives and we've been on social media for most of, if not all of our adult lives. I think that as we move forward, especially in high profile situations like government or like, you know, like elections, all of the people running pretty soon will have had a social media presence for more than 10 years. And that's, again, a little scary, but also I think freeing in a way, you know, again, helping people to see other people, as humans, you know, and even in our digital world where we're glued to our phones or our computers, you know, 24 hours a day, we can continue to make personal connections with people through those mediums, using them as a tool rather than kind of hiding behind a private life.
I agree. That's so interesting. I think we're going to hear more about that in the future. So I want to pivot just a little bit. As an HR leader, when you're looking at potential candidates, I'd like for you to comment on how important communication skills are, even for someone who's coming in to take on a technical role.
I think that communication skills are extremely important. And one of the best transferable skills, I continue to think about this word transferable, or this phrase transferable skills, because it's all over the place, especially when you transition from the military. But I think that communication skills are one of my top transferable skills. And it's really probably been the skill that's helped me transition the most. When we're hiring or even applying for a job, how we convey ourselves is very important. So those communication skills are vitally important to getting the job, but also to being good at your job. One of the things that comes to mind when I think about communication as a skill is the ability to translate from one team to another or from one job to another. Again, thinking about the transferable skills mindset. In the military, when I was briefing generals or briefing, you know, operations leaders, they speak a different language than intel people. And so it's very important to have the skill to be able to translate between them. Because if I'm speaking my language to them, they're not going to understand a word I'm saying, right? And the whole point of the conversation is to have them understand what I'm trying to convey to them. And I think that in an interview setting, it comes across so plainly. It's very clear whether or not you've practiced your stories, whether or not you know what the point is that you're trying to make. I think when I was going through my MBA, interview skills and getting a job are really paramount, especially for UF MBA as a program. And that's a little plug, but Career Services, number one in, we say the universe, but in the nation, number one Career Services, because they prepare us so well for the interview. And one of the important messages is know the point you're making, but have a story to tell for every point that you're making, and be able to tell that story in different ways to highlight different points. And that to me highlights the skill that it's not only what you say, but how you say it that matters. And for technical roles, especially, that translation piece comes in even more importantly. I have a story about my dad, actually. He is now, you know, I said he's retired from the military, but he is a second career. He's a senior business analyst for Disney. And he's come up through the ranks. He started as a, you know, as a business analyst and continued to kind of work up. And he, one of the things that he's known for around the company is that he takes very technical data. He can build a dashboard, or he builds a macro, a program that will run itself. So that's the first part. It makes it easy to use, gives it a user interface. And then the icing on top is that he gives it a cute name that's usually an acronym. So one of the products that he created was called the Parking Lot Utilization Tool Online. And as you can tell from the name, it's a tool that they use to help manage and optimize what parking lots they're using and how full they are at the Disney parks. But if you take the first letter of each of those words, it spells Pluto. Pluto is a Disney character. And so my dad creates a little logo with the character attached. And now people are like, oh, are you using Pluto? People don't have to say, oh, are you using that new tool for parking lot stuff? You know, it gives him a brand. And so by sharpening his communication skills and thinking about how he conveys his very technical data to people who maybe aren't very technical, he's elevated his status and his brand with the company and continued to be able to move forward in his career.
Wow, that's fantastic. What other communication advice can you share for our listeners?
When I was going through Intel school, a friend of mine had a hard time giving briefings. She knew all the information. She knew exactly what she wanted to say. But on the day of the presentation, she would get nervous. She would rush through. her presentation, and it always just sounded like she, didn't really know what she was talking about. And I gave her this advice, and it really helped her out. And that was to watch YouTube videos or listen to speeches by famous orators. So people like John F. Kennedy, Roosevelt, Barack Obama, Martin Luther King Jr., and to listen to what makes their speech great. And that sounds very generic. You're like, well, how do I know if I'm not already good? But I have a very specific thing to listen to. Listen to the cadence of their speech. If you listen to people who are great orators or perceived as great orators, they will have a cadence to the way they speak, and they'll enunciate differently or extra depending on the point they're trying to make. And I think that it highlights the point that it's not always about what you say, but it's definitely about how you say it just as much. And for me specifically, I like to speak quickly. I'm sure you'll get that sense from this podcast, but I do that in presentations as well. I like to speak quickly. But because I speak quickly, I have to enunciate very clearly so that people don't lose the words that I'm saying. And I'm very careful about where I put the emphasis on things. But I learned all of that from listening to great speakers. And I think that that's really a skill that anybody can sharpen just by watching and really focusing and honing in on things like cadence and tone, and enunciation. So that's some very practical communication advice for folks.
Jenna, I just want to talk about your education background, which is very fascinating to say the least. So you have your master's degree, and that's great. But I also want to highlight a few other things that I think for some would be somewhat unusual. For instance, you attended Squadron Officer College, Intelligence Formal Training, the American Military University, Nuclear Weapons Basic Certification. When people find out about this, are they surprised? I'm just curious. I'm thinking non-military personnel.
People are surprised that a big, bubbly, outgoing personality like me, who admittedly loves everything Disney, I like unicorns. I turned 30 this year. I had a unicorn birthday cake because, it's okay to be a little extra. You just got to like the things that you like. And but yeah, it's a little surprising for people to see that, especially if they've met me in that context in my personal life, to then realize or learn some of the things that I've done and learned throughout my time, in the military. I think when I started my MBA program, everybody stands up at the beginning of the program, and I'm in a cohort of 36 people, so we're a very small program by design, and everybody stands up and kind of says what they've done before, what their expertise is in. And I think people, I'm carrying a hot pink Mickey backpack into class, and people are thinking like, this girl is in something creative, probably is what they're thinking. And I say, hi, my name is Jen Barkenhagen, and I was on active duty as an intelligence officer with the Air Force for the last 6 years. My last role was at Shaw Air Force Base as the chief of targets, where I was responsible for future planning and current operations for targeting in the Middle East. And people are like, what? You did what? How does this bubbly little person, do all of that? And it really does come down to just learning, and the choices that I've made in my life have led me down this path. And it's funny to think about our non-military men surprised. I think everybody's surprised, honestly. Non-military men and women, I think, are surprised. Military people, maybe not so much. They get it. Everybody's got a diverse background or has been to trainings based on the job that they, are assigned to do. We don't necessarily get to pick, what assignment we go to next. And so when you get there, you learn all about it. You go to a school, 6 weeks or your 8 weeks of training, and now you're an expert in that thing. So military people kind of get it, I think. But yeah, non-military people often are surprised. But usually it's a good surprise, I think. I think the scarier surprise is when people learn that some of those courses that are not listed are like self-defense, combatives, hand-to-hand close, like close quarters combat and things like that. People are very surprised. I'm like, yeah, I could take you down if I needed to. Don't crush me. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, people are definitely surprised by some of the things that I've done or things that I've classes I've taken or courses I've accomplished. So, yeah.
I know for many, attending basic training is life-changing. I have a number of close family relatives who have gone through training in different branches of the service, and you know, and speaking with them, it was life-changing. Wasn't that the case for you? Were there any aha moments that you look back and say, you know, my training influenced me?
Yeah, so for officers, it's a little bit different. So we don't go to like the traditional basic training that a lot of people talk about, but went through ROTC, we go through a program called field training, which is essentially a shorter version of basic training, but with leadership implications. So they give you a handbook beforehand, and you're expected to memorize and know this handbook and then be able to lead based on the things in this handbook. And it's more of a test of leadership. But it also comes with all of the things you hear about basic training, a lot of yelling, sleeping in bunk beds, you know, quick meals, marching everywhere you go. So those aspects of it definitely are all there. I think for me, the biggest aha moment came a little bit after. And that was, I was talking to a cadet who had been in charge of my squadron at field training. So he was basically with us all the time, yelling at us, making us do, you know, everything that needed to be done. And later on, you know, in life, we were having a conversation, and he said to me, if field training was a one-day event, you would have been the top graduate. And at first I was a little offended. I was like, what does that mean? Is this a backhanded compliment? Like, what are you trying to say? But when we talked about it more, he said that I came into our squadron and I came into that training with a ton of confidence and a ton of skills. And I was good. I was a great leader. And on day two or three, they said, you know what, you've had a leadership position within the flight for a couple of days. And so now we're going to see how you do as a follower. And we're also going to give some other people the opportunity to lead. And I was like, yep, all for it. There are, you know, 20 of us in this flight, and we all need to prove ourselves. We're all going to be officers in the Air Force. And so I took a step back from the leadership spotlight, and I did everything I could to make those leaders that were in charge and were showing their, you know, their skills and capability, I did everything I could to make them successful. And never again in the 4 weeks or 5 weeks of this encampment did I have another directly assigned leadership position. And so he said, you never took leadership back. You never stepped into the limelight and showed your skills again. And so in the eyes of the, you know, the leaders who were grading everybody, you sort of just faded away. And I thought about that for a long time, and I came to think of it, I come to perceive it as actually a compliment on what I consider one of the greatest parts of my leadership style. And that's that I've always genuinely felt that the success of others, of those around me and those I lead, is more important than my own personal success. And, you know, that in the ambition column, that's definitely a minus. but for me, it's more important to see those people that I lead be successful, or in the case of field training, those people around me who are also trying really hard and deserved an opportunity. It was in my power to make them successful. Then why wouldn't I do that? And sometimes in the corporate world, it seems, you know, people will push each other aside or step on people to be successful. You know, the impression is that if you want to be successful, you have to be the one sort of charging forward and making that happen. And while that's probably true, and my perception or my kind of viewpoint on the topic is probably a negative in the ambition column, but it's always been more important to me to have those around me or those that I supervise be successful in the limelight and be seen as successful than it has been for me to be successful. For me, it's more fulfilling for those that I lead to be, you know, seen as rock stars. That's fulfilling for me because I'm like, I led that person. I helped them become what they are today. And for me, that's more important. And so to that end, when I was at Shaw Air Force Base, I led a team of about 17 people. I was a flight commander. And now there were four or five other flight commanders within our shop that did, and each flight did something different. Because of the nature of the work that we did, we had a lot of high-ranking, high-visibility visitors on a regular basis. And so it was very normal for, you know, a 2-star general or a full bird colonel to be walking around and to be getting small presentations from each of the flight commanders on what it was that their flight does every day and how they do it well and kind of, you know, what they're thinking about for the future, things like that. Well, it was very normal, like I said, for the flight commanders to give that presentation. But for my flight, it was always one of my airmen. Unless directed by my boss that I had to give this presentation or somebody else wasn't available, I always made sure that one of my younger airmen got the opportunity to stand in front of this high-ranking official in the military and tell them that we are really, really good at our job. Here's what we do, and here's why we're so good at it. And I think it spoke more to the fact that these are the airmen doing the job. And so it was very important to me that they were the ones in the spotlight getting the recognition. And I think one of my proudest moments is having one of my airmen coined by a general. And if you're unfamiliar with the term or with the process, being coined means that I've given you a token, a round metal object, a coin with some inscription on it, my name, my rank, my position, a quote that's important to me, something like that. Everybody's is different. I've given you this coin as a token of recognition for the great job that you've done. I'm recognizing that you just did an awesome job, and I'm going to give you one of these tokens for that. So being coined is a big honor, especially by a general or, you know, a high-ranking official. And so the first time that happened, when one of my airmen was coined because he did such a great job in this presentation, and a presentation that was all flight commanders until him. So all officers, all captains or majors, and then senior airmen. And he was so impressive that he was the one that got coined. I don't think I've ever been more proud in my life because I knew that I mentored him. I helped him become what he is today. And I was pushing my baby bird out of the nest, and he flew and did an amazing job. So it's always been more important. And it's something that I'm not willing to give up ever, is that those around me and those that report to me will always be the focus of, you know, the spotlight in my opinion.
You're going to get a lot of people reaching out to you because they're going to want to work for you. So let me ask you, where do you see yourself 5 years from now? What would you like to be doing?
You know, that's a good question. I'm terrible at goal setting. I will be the first to admit I probably buy a new planner every year to try to like try a new type of goal setting or the secret to setting goals and keeping with them. I'm just bad at it. So I don't know what I want to do in 5 years. I don't know where I want to be. I try to think of this as this is my second career. You know, I did my time on active duty in the Air Force. I consider that sort of my first career, and that was very directive. Sort of where you go and what you do next is always told to you, and then you make the most of the place that you're put. Now, I'm in the corporate world. I have all of this freedom, all of this control to do, you know, what I want to do, to go where I want to go, and you know, I don't really know what's next. It may be that I'm a director at Wyndham Destinations, or I'm a VP at Wyndham Destinations, if things go really well. But maybe it's that I, you know, have opened my own company or done something completely different. Maybe I'm an L&D. I have honestly no idea, and I actually embrace that fact that I'm going to take the opportunities as they come, and I'm going to make those decisions kind of as I come to them. So if you ask me kind of what am I going to be doing this year, maybe I have a better answer, but what am I going to be doing in 5 or 10 years? We'll have to see where the wind takes me, I think.
No, I understand. Well, let me give you one recommendation. I think one of the things you should do is write a book. You have superior leadership and communication skills. And so I think you should write a book. It should be called Take Flight: Best Practices in Leadership and Communication Skills. And, you know, if you need a co-author or some help with that, let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. You've already got some great ideas. I think this is a partnership in the making for sure.
Well, I would absolutely be honored. Thank you so much. So, if folks want to get in contact with you, how can they do that?
I think the best way is probably LinkedIn. I have a LinkedIn profile. It's Jen with two N's, Barkenhagen. I'm probably the only one, pretty uncommon last name. So, if you find any other Barkenhagens out there, we're probably related.
Well, all right. We'll keep that in mind. Jen, thank you so much for coming on to the show. It has been an absolute pleasure, and I hope to speak with you real soon.
Thank you so much for having me. This is my first podcast experience, and it's been awesome. And I really enjoyed talking to you and kind of getting to explore some of these exciting thoughts and, you know, on leadership and communication and how we can really be present in our digital world.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much again for joining me. It would mean so much if you would comment, like, and certainly subscribe to this podcast. We'll be updating it frequently with a variety of guests, so please stay tuned.